And thank you for coming to our first Hot Topics presentation. Every morning, well, today, Friday, Saturday, at 9 o'clock, the call intersection thought about some topics that a lot of people are interested in related to technology. So we're going to have four of these. We have one at 9 today, one at 9 tomorrow, one at 9 on Saturday, and then there's another one Saturday afternoon. And so we invite you to come to these. These are supposed to be brief surveys of topics that are, well, contemporary, people are interested in. So the one that you're at today is called Flipping the Classroom. Our session is going to run for an hour and 15 minutes. I'm going to try to keep our speakers to about 12 minutes for each presentation to preserve a lot of time at the end for people to engage the audience a little bit. Okay, we have a very logical order for this panel. We're going to start off a little bit theoretical, and then we're going to go all the way through practice and eventually into assessment with the four panelists. This is a great group of people, and I personally think we're quite lucky to have them all here in the same place at the same time. Let me start. The first presenter I want to talk about is Lane Marshall. Lane's from Long Island University. In Hudson, and she's going to talk a little bit, again, the theoretical part, giving us a definition and a little bit of theory about flipping the classroom.
Okay, you know, the secret agenda today is to convert you all, right? Although, how many of you have ever heard of flipped learning before? Okay, how many of you have, hold up your hands, keep them up, how many of you ever tried it? Okay, so we have some who have heard of it but haven't tried it, some who have heard of it and tried it, and some new folks. So I thought I would start. My title is, what is flipped learning and why should I try it? Okay. And one of the reasons I chose this title is that there's been some confusion about just what is flipping and what is not. And I thought what it would be helpful to do is to begin by clarifying the concept itself, and then present a rationale for it. And then the other speakers will talk to you more about what it looks like in classrooms and how to implement it effectively. So what I use as a definition of flipped learning is from the Flipped Learning Network. And we came up with this definition last year, 2004. And as I read it, you can see the flavor of what flipped learning is going for. There's no one flipped learning or flipped classroom. Everybody does it differently, but we tried to come up with a definition that in and of itself could encompass whatever people are doing in their various contexts that constitutes flipped learning. So it is a pedagogical approach in which direct instruction moves from the group learning space to the individual learning space, class to home. And the resulting group space is transformed into a dynamic, interactive learning environment, that's very important, where the educator guides students as they apply concepts and engage creatively in the subject matter. And in red, you know, I've indicated some of the key phrases that are important. And you notice here we're using the term flipped learning, and many people talk about a flipped classroom. So I would like to distinguish the two, at least from my perspective, what is meant by the two of them. So for the flipped classroom, I think of it as simply we switch. We switch. So whatever you did in class is done at home. Whatever you used to do or at home, have your students do, they're going to do in class. That's just a switch. That's the first step most people take. But if that's all you do, you're not really doing flipped learning. We're not really just having students come in class and do their homework while you walk around the room. That's not flipped learning. So it's very important that you see that distinction. Flipped learning looks more like this. So what we do in flipped learning is we try and make it dynamic at home, interactive at home, not just a talking head lecture, but something dynamic with interactive activities and quizzes and questions and comments at home, all built into whatever you put up digitally. You'll hear more about that later. And it doesn't even have to be digital, which is another point. And then in class, we want it to be very dynamic and collaborative so that students are working together. And now I have some comments. We had an EVO, you know, Electronic Village Online this year. For the first time, we had a flipped learning session with about 200 or 300 folks. And we asked them a question. After they've had a couple of weeks with us, we asked in the third week this essential question: how is planning flipped learning lessons different from conventional lesson planning? And how do you feel about those differences? And I'm just going to show you a couple of quick quotes for how they answered this question. So, for example, our first question for the conventional was, content is primarily presented in class and application of content and exercises done for homework out of class. That's pretty much the traditional way. And in flipping, students gather information. Notice the word gather, this person said. I think that's very good. Gather information largely outside of class by reading, watching recorded lectures, listening to podcasts. So they come to class eager to participate. Notice, eager to participate. We're going to talk about that in a minute. And apply what they learn to new concepts. All right, the next was the teacher's role. So someone said, well, as a teacher, I used to have absolute control over everything that happened in the classroom. All right, now that might not always be true, but this is the comment from this particular teacher. And we had, I should say, people from, it was very international, put it that way. And now, the flipped class learning teachers are not central figures, but are more facilitators. So that's another huge shift, is your role. And third, what are you concerned about? Well, in conventional planning, you're concerned about covering, getting through the semester and covering everything you have to do. Whereas in flipped learning, the biggest challenge is thinking about being creative, finding more ways to have students engage and produce the target language in class. So the focus shifts, too, in terms of what your concerns are. And I just want to give you a brief history. If you want, we're not going to discuss any of these, but you should be familiar if you want to learn about the history of flipped learning with the following. Mazur actually got the ball rolling, and that was at higher education level, teaching physics at Harvard. And he said, why should I stand here and lecture like I'm doing right now? He said, I'll send my students home. They can look at my lecture notes and think about them, and then they come to class, and instead of delivering the lecture, we'll talk about clarifying. That was very early on, okay? And he called it peer instruction because what he did, and still does, is he has huge lecture halls and they have clickers, and he asks some questions and the responses come up on the screen and he can see what people are answering and clarify, even though he has large classes. So large classes, you know, is not a deal breaker for flipped learning. All right, next, this is kind of the seminal article, Lageplot and Treglia. You really need to read this. This is, they called it inverting the classroom. Terminology is crazy for this, so when you Google it, be careful, because there are a lot of different ways to find information on it. But they called it inverting classroom, same idea, but they talked about, for the first time, getting more multimedia involved as opposed to just the lecture notes, actual audio, video, using the tools that have been developed for technological delivery. So that was theirs, and they do have some data in that article and got some good results, so you'll want to read that. And then finally, Bergman and Sams, they're at K-12 level, and they got involved with their chemistry classes in high school, and then it really took off. The K-12 world has embraced flipped learning way beyond anyone else. We're catching up, adult ed is catching up, higher ed is catching up, but the epicenter of it is definitely science and math classes, and that's where the term flipped learning started to be used more. That's very quick history. My next question, flavor of the month. So you know how we call this a hot topic session? Well, everyone's always worried about something, you know, it's a flash in the pan, is this something, you know, or should I get on the bandwagon, you know, all those cliches, you know? And so I teach methods. So I always ask my students, I say, look, I'm not always going to be your methods instructor, and something's going to come down the pike long after this class. So I want you to always ask three questions to decide whether something does have staying power and whether you should jump on board. And the three questions are, what might appeal to teachers about this approach? What might appeal to learners? And what does the research say that supports it? So I'm going to very quickly go through those three questions. First, why do teachers like flipped learning? What appeals to them? First of all, it saves time. Remember, you're delegating out your teacher-centered piece. It's gone. So there's no more teacher up in the front teaching. So you're definitely going to save time. Next, we talked earlier about the role. Now, what will your role be? Instead of teaching, what you're doing is you're observing students, giving them feedback, and doing informal assessment. This role, by the way, can also be the students doing it, too. That's a separate presentation. So you're shifting your role, and I've had people say at the higher ed level, well, if I don't lecture, what do I do? They're not in TESOL. Okay. In any case, you also get better results from your students. They learn more. I can testify to that. If you're interested, I have data from my classes. They really do, well, you'll hear more from the other speakers. Definitely get some good results from your students. Next is the students. So why do the students like flipped learning? And they don't all like it. You're going to hear more about that later. But one reason they like it is they get ownership of their learning. They take a lesson home. It's their lesson now. They can do whatever they want. They can watch it three times. They can watch it, you know, once. They can just pause. They can do whatever they want. They can click links in it. They can do whatever they want with their learning. They own it. It's their lesson. It's not the teacher's lesson. Very important for them. Okay? The next is when they walk into class, it's not, okay, I'm here, start the lesson. The teacher doesn't start the lesson. The lesson just starts. So it's wonderful that they're active from the very, very beginning they walk in the room. That's important. And it's a big shift, I've noticed, affectively. And the last is they get constant support from peers and the teacher. In anything that they're doing, somebody's there to help them at any time. So that's extremely important. They feel supported. As you know, for second language acquisition, that's key. And what about the research? Well, I looked at three different areas. One is affective. So what their studies are finding is that we get more motivation, more participation, and the attendance goes up. There's just a better feeling about the course. It's a shift. And that they're finding that across all levels of education. And the next is in terms of cognitively, what's happening is that there's, as I said before, increased mastery of concepts and more time for critical thinking because they don't spend as much time just getting the basic concepts. In class, like you saw in the definition, they're applying, they're creative in their learning. So we know that that results in stronger learning, okay? Not just the language, but using the language for creative thinking and critical thinking. And last, metacognitively, I like this one because, you know, you always say, the teacher says, do you get it? Do you get it? Well, when it's flipped learning, the student says, do I get it? Do I get it? And if I don't get it, what can I do in order to get it? So we've completely flipped that question. So those are the reasons that I think people like flipped learning in general. And then very quickly, I just wanted to put in a slide for us, for second language acquisition. So what does it mean for us? First of all, comprehension, second, interaction, and third, critical thinking skills. So for comprehension, they now have multiple input from different sources. They get input at home. They get input in class from peers. And in terms of interaction, they're getting much more meaningful interaction in class. And even at home, they're kind of interacting with the video if you do it well. And I'm sure there'll be people later talking about how do you do that. Critical thinking skills, they're able to do more cognitively demanding tasks, again, because we've farmed out the lower levels of Bloom, which, by the way, I wanted to show you Bloom. People talk about flipping Bloom. So in other words, we take the upper levels of Bloom in class. The lower levels are at home. So this is a very, very quick orientation for you to get you started and prepare you for the other speakers who are going to take it from here. But I have one slight announcement, which is that if you are interested in flipped learning, there is an annual conference. You can attend it in person or virtually. You can ask me a lot more about it later, but it's the flipped learning conference, FlipCon 15, okay, if you're interested. And I do have a handout on with the definition and a checklist for flipped learning, but it's downloadable on the site of this organization if you're interested later. And I will pass it to Christine. Are you in? Okay.
Thank you.
Ling, that was great. I think you're probably going to be hard-pressed to find 12 minutes in your life that you're going to get that good an overview that quickly. Thank you very much. Because I was interested in starting on time, I forgot to acknowledge our session here is being webcast around the globe. So I wanted to say hello to those of you on the webcast, and we will be taking some questions also at the end of the session from the people who are on the webcast. Now let me move on to our second speaker. Our second speaker is Christine Sabia. She's from Notre Dame University in Lebanon. And she's going to move more from the theoretical overview to some more practical, or I won't say practical, more down-to-earth considerations like how to set up flipped learning and factors to think about when you're designing it. So Christine.
We need to get out of here. Morning. I'm the devil's advocate. I entitled my presentation this morning, How Simple Is It to Flip? And it is simple, if you assume it is simple. So as my abstract basically said, the way I see it, that many educators today are attempting to transform their classrooms, whether traditional or learner-centered, into a flip environment, so into the flipped classroom. But the idea is they assume things are a miracle fix the moment you just reverse something that is traditional methodology, you introduce the idea of blended learning, or you just introduce technology into your classroom and they assume learning has improved. So my question is it so simple an endeavor to flip? And the question is, what are you trying to flip? Are you trying to flip the classroom or are you trying to flip learning? So the answer would be it's simple if you have all the components of what makes an effective teaching learning environment. But it's not so simple if some of the elements or some of the components are missing. So basically I have four purposes this morning. One is to consider or decide what it is that we want to do as educators or teachers. And I believe once we're trying to flip, we become educators more than teachers. To move our students forward. I want us to be aware of the elements that we need to consider and then decide what exactly is it that we want to flip. Do we want to flip the classroom if we want to flip it, or do we want to flip the learning? So just to go over the what I call the teaching learning effective equation, you've got the teacher, the student, the learning theories and conditions, because that's what we're drawing on basically, the subject matter that we're teaching, the tools that we have, tools and resources, and of course the instructional methods plus the activities and the assessment, and finally the learning space itself. So if we're going to think of flipped learning, we're thinking in terms of integrating the instructional methods plus the activity and the assessment. So that would be what we're focusing on when it comes to learning. And if we're thinking about flipping a classroom, we're flipping the environment. So this is our, you know, the little picture here is what we usually think about, the little triangle. And we always say to ourselves we need to have a dynamic relationship. So we always used to think teaching, learning, assessment in a space, okay? But when we want to make things more active, we need to ask ourselves, what is it that needs to be learned? How well is the learning happening? What kind of instructional technology am I using to support the learning? And how am I measuring my learning? So instead of thinking about teaching, learning, assessment as a triangle in a space, what we're looking at is learning, the support that goes with that learning, the supportive teaching, and finally the assessment. So as Lane just told us, when she described the flipped classroom for us, the idea here is we need to focus on action. what happens before the class versus what happens during the class. And I've highlighted some of the points in the definition. Watch students engage in lectures, they watch outside the class, then dedicated time is for doing homework. Students are allowed to ask questions, you come in and you do collaborative work. So it's not the day-to-day struggle getting that message across to the students, having them go home, do the homework, come back, check the homework. So it's not that dynamic relationship that we're looking at. It's more, we're focusing more on the action. And when we're focusing on flipped learning, the focus now is on the act of learning, the idea of learning. So yes, it is a new pedagogical approach, and you're moving from direct instruction towards group learning in a space where within that space you have individual learning because you have the group learning. So it's that dynamic of what is happening to ensure that learning is actually being practiced. And the teacher comes in and guides and helps the students apply the concepts, understand the concepts, and engage more creatively in the subject matter. So what is it that we expect? We expect learner-centered teaching to happen, or learner-centered learning to happen in that space. Students are taking more responsibility of their learning, and they're expected to monitor it. The educators are the planners, the guides, the facilitators, the mentors, the coach. I mean, we could go on with those descriptions. Students are working not only individually, but usually in pairs and groups, and of course, based on the activity that they're being asked to do, they're allowed to inquire, project, collaborate, engage. So there's a lot of active learning taking place, and the key thing is higher order learning taking place in that space. But the idea is, does that always happen? So if we go back to the equation and we say yes, ultimately what we're doing when we're flipping, we're ensuring that there is a shift. There's a shift in the energy of learning. There's the shift in the energy of the action that takes place in the classroom. We're removing the energy from the instructor as such, and we're pushing that energy towards the student. And we're using tools to enhance that. That's basically what we just heard from Lane. But my concern is, if I go back to the equation, I have three basic concerns. The concern, and you see them, you see what my biggest concern is, the student. Okay, so teacher, yes, is a concern, because the teacher's the mindset. Okay, the tools are a concern, but my biggest concern is the students. Not the methodology, not the learning theories, and not the subject matter, and not the space that they're in. Okay, so my concern is the teacher, the tools, and the students. So the role of the teacher changes. We saw that, Lane mentioned that. Teacher, it's assumed teacher knows content, teacher knows where to take the students. That's an assumption. But the idea is the planning of that learning environment. How well does the teacher know what needs to be planned to take those students to the point that they need to learn in this new environment? How well does the teacher know to be the shadow to ensure that student is learning? We're giving the students the responsibility for their own learning to ask the question, why and how and have I learned? But can the teacher play the role of the shadow? We need to make our students shine, but how much shining has to take place? Okay, so the confidence that needs to be built by the teacher needs to become confident in being able to do this, but the students also have to have the confidence to be able to do that. In terms of the tools, plenty out there, tech-based or non-tech-based. A lot of stuff teachers try to design and create, but they don't have to. A lot of it is out there, okay? They just need to know what it is that they can use to help plan their classrooms or the homework. There's a lot of research available, and the idea is you need to know what it is that you want, So do you know what you want and what it is that you can find out there or what it is that you need to develop? So the selection of tools and resources depends on what it is that you want and what is available for you. People who teach in the Western world don't have the same opportunities for teachers who teach in the developing world or underdeveloped world. And I happen to teach in a developing world, so not everything is there for me. So basically, our focus before was on the acquisition of the basic knowledge, the lower levels of Bloom. And now, when we're trying to introduce the concept of FLIP, our focus is on the upper levels. Okay? So, as I said, my concern is the students. The true essence of the FLIP is really the focus on the students. The type of learner that we have. Think of the type of learners you have. The personalities. What kind of students do you have? Do you have lazy students? I have lazy students. When I assign for them to watch YouTube, they say, what? We're going to spend time watching YouTube? You complain about reading. You don't want to read. I'm giving you something to watch, and they still complain. So I don't know if my students are unique in that sense, but I'm sure students are like that. Okay? So the idea of the type of student, the type of learner, the personality, the attitude, the behavior they have. How about language proficiency? How well do they know the language to be able to read something, to understand? And if you're teaching a concept, how well are they able to grasp that concept, to then come into the classroom to then apply it? Okay? The ability to process meaning, the idea of how secure are they in becoming their own teachers to ensure that they're learning the material. So the ability to be responsible for their own learning. To a certain extent, the socioeconomic status affects, because some of them do not have the opportunities that they have at home that they would have in a classroom, and that's something we need to consider. Time management, and then the availability of facilities, you know? So the idea is, if we do have the four pillars to FLIP, okay, the flexible environment, the learning culture, the intentional content, the professional educator, then yes, it is a very simple endeavor. Now, I have the four pillars, and I still face difficulty because I've overcome the tool issues, but the learner issue is a constant battle day in, day out. Okay, and I've highlighted attitude, behavior, language, the ability to process, the responsibility, and the time management as the key issues we need to consider when we're thinking about students. So one, did I help you consider or decide what it is that you want to do? Yes, by bringing in the equation. Are we now aware of the elements? Yes. The three elements that we really need to focus on: tools, educator, and students. Did we decide if we want to flip a classroom? Yes. Did we decide if we want to flip learning? Yes. So it's not a question of knowing how to flip and trying to flip. It's a question of how well do you know your students to flip. And I think that's the key to the whole equation of the flip, the buzzword flip. Thank you. And I don't have a handout because I was just being a devil's advocate. But if you have any questions or comments, that's my email. Thank you. And now we're going to move on to the more practical side of flipping.
Thank you, Christine. And now we'll move on to our third presenter, who's also our second Christine. Christine Bauer Ramzani. She teaches at St. Michael's in Vermont, and she's going to talk to us about how to execute a flipped room classroom and discuss results.
I have to apologize up front. I hope I'm not going to get a coughing spell during my talk. So bear with me if I do, please. I sent around a handout with the slides, so I hope that's going to be helpful. If you need a copy of the slides or any of the, I've got a lot of resources on my last slide, you can find them at that link that is at the bottom there. So now that we have heard about the definition and how easy or rather how difficult it might be to flip the classroom, I want to show you some examples of what I did with my own classes and some of the results. So when we've got a flipped classroom, we've already alluded to the combination of several elements here. So we've got blended learning. I'm going to bring in another element which has been alluded to but maybe not mentioned specifically, and that is mLearning or mobile learning. And when I use the flipped learning, I do it with a combination of a project-based learning approach, which is PBL. So what we're doing with technology, and since this is our topic here in the call intersection, technology allows us to shift our classroom to a different environment and that different space that was mentioned. And in doing so, we use blended learning, of course. Now, by definition, blended learning is a combination of face-to-face learning and working online. Students access resources to the web or other places outside of class, and they bring their learning to class. Thus, flipping the classroom goes hand in hand with blended learning. Mobile devices and mobile learning. This is where the flipped classroom meets mobile learning, as Aaron Sam said, one of the originators from the K-12 flipping the classroom environment. And in particular, mobile phones have increased our efficiency and effectiveness to flip the classroom, because students can use their mobile phones and their tablets, if they use them appropriately, to access information. And all they need is Wi-Fi. They can also post the output of their work, such as in the form of text or audio or video that they have created. In addition to the mobile devices, my students tend to bring their laptops. So I have a mixture of devices in my classroom. I've got mobile devices, I've got phones, tablets, and laptops. So that is called BYOD, bring your own device. So I've got that going on in my classroom. And what that means is that all of these devices are and must be capable of accessing web materials. And when the students bring those to class and they have done some of their work on those devices or at home, then we've got a combination of the flipped classroom, mLearning, and blended learning and BYOD. And so now I'm going to talk about the next ingredient, which is project-based learning. I find that in order for my teaching and my students to be effective, it's best to have a project going on. So, excuse me, and I've worked with project-based learning over the years, quite a few years actually. Project-based learning was pioneered by the Buck Institute. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It is used as an approach that is based on inquiry-based learning. Students have to find the answers to an important question, which means, and they have to do it collaboratively. They have to, they have to collaborate on their projects. They have to co-construct meaning. This was alluded to earlier. And they have to present the outcome, in English, of course. And typically, projects then are assessed with alternative means of assessment, and that is what John is going to be talking about. And so some of those would be checklists and rubrics. In addition, as you can see on the right side here, and that has been discussed, PBL, just like flipped learning, incorporates Bloom's taxonomy of higher order thinking skills, where learners move up the ladder of critical thinking from remembering to understanding, to applying the concepts, to analyzing, to synthesizing, and finally to creating. Now, this highest level creating represents the synthesis of higher order thinking skills. And so when you see that they have to work in a project, they are forced to synthesize the information and then present it as an outcome to the class. And that could be in the form of a PowerPoint slideshow, it could be in a brochure, it could be a digital story, it could be a video or some other example of their creativity. So when we combine those elements, blended learning, BYOD, mobile learning, and project-based learning, that is when I was able to flip my classroom. So I wanted to show you how I did it and look at some of the methodology that I used. So here's my class. And I tried this out recently. So it was last fall, the last fall session, in the intensive English program at St. Michael's College. The class met two times each week for 2.5 hours on Tuesday and Thursday, so for a total of 5 hours per week. I had 13 intermediate to high intermediate ESL students. They were from China, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, and Japan. They were all between 18 and 21 years old, so your typical age of college age. The topic that I had chosen was current events. And I'm sure that's a fairly popular topic around intensive English programs all over the place. The main purpose of the course was to increase the students' listening and academic skills. So I always try to hit several stones, birds with one stone. It's not just flipping the classroom for whatever. They had to do some academic skills and some heavy-duty learning as well. Since it was an elective course in our program, I did have some freedom to design the class the way I wanted to. So here's the flipped classroom in action. As we have already mentioned, there are in-class and out-of-class activities in the flipped classroom. In other words, there is homework, okay? But this homework consisted of intentional content and language practice. In class, the students learned note-taking skills from me and summarizing skills from me. They had to practice them outside the classroom. They had to choose websites that I gave them, and you see them up there. You're probably familiar with them, TED Talks, Voice of America, Learning English, Breaking News English, and I used English Central. So, and they had other links available to them if they had wanted to avail themselves of them. So once they listened to something using those links, they had to post a summary in a shared Google Drive document, which I called their current events news log. And you can see an example on the bottom right here. This is what their news log actually looked like. So they had to post the author, the date, the source, the summary, and you can see some faintly, but you can see some comments that I made. I also commented on a few of their language items that were systematic errors that recurred. So in class then, once the students had done that, they came to class with their notes on the event that they had listened to, and they had to give timed oral summaries in a minute and a half of those news events using the notes that they had taken. Remember, this was academic skills also. First, they had to share some vocabulary. Then they had to give the summary, again, in a minute and a half. And then they had to answer some questions of clarification from their partner. So we can look at an example of this.
Almost 3 months that the numbers are good for investment and to go back the following year.
Our topic is some of the slides.
I have no idea what's going on.
Okay, so quiz time. This is from Danielle and Carolyn. What were some of the popular methods of the 20th century? And this is from Richards. It went to my YouTube channel. Okay, sorry about that. So anyway, this looked like a typical classroom to you, of course, okay, typical interactive activity. The students loved it, and they got a lot out of it, and this is what was so important to me. They really brought their learning to the classroom, what they had done at home, and they were happy to share it. They got really involved in the questions. So remember, the partner had not heard this content, so there were lots of questions and lots of clarification. So the students got really, really involved in this, and they commented on the evaluation forms. That was their favorite activity. Okay. And you know, when I had to stop them, you know, when you have to stop students from talking, that indicates that you've really done something well. So that's what happened in this case. And it was all happening in English, which was great. Okay, now I think I'm on the wrong slide here. Yeah, this is the actual project that they did that I chose. So about halfway through the session, so 4 weeks in, I decided to have them do this newscast project. Mind you, I had planned this beforehand, but I wasn't sure if it was going to work. So it did, and it was kind of the culmination of this whole course. The students had to play the role of a news anchor who was interviewing an expert. So there were two students paired up. One was the anchor, one was the expert, and it was a true project-based learning type of experiment, where the students chose the content, they had to research it, they negotiated the input and the output in terms of the language and the technology. They could choose however they wanted to present this, and it represents the top of Benjamin Bloom's pyramid, because they had to create something, they had to analyze, they had to use research, they had to synthesize the research, and they had to evaluate the information for whether it was valuable or not. So each class day, I devoted a little bit of time to this project, not the entire 2.5 hours, no way, about 45 minutes each time. The students discussed the content of their project. They composed storyboards or outlines, so that was written text. They had to revise their work. They had to revise the storyboards. I helped with that. They had to practice pronunciation and delivery, and they had to record the newscast. So I've got some examples of that. How are we doing on time? 1 minute. Okay. I think I'm going to skip the example. If we have some time at the end, we can get to it. But you have it on, if you go to my website, you have it. So what happened in the end is the final newscast, I did a polling in class, and we had, I can't remember, six of them, and the best one we might be able to show. So I used poll everywhere to find out which one they liked the best. And here it is. I'll show it to you at the very end. It's very short, but I think it's important to address some of these advantages and disadvantages. Some of them were mentioned before, so I'll skip over those that were already mentioned. We know about blended learning. It increases the students' exposure to English. We have a need for formative assessment, and John is going to address that. In class, there was a lot of time for discussing, analyzing, and debating. The students were really prepared. Disadvantages. It took a lot of my planning time to put all of this together, especially to have the scaffolding, the language activities, that storyboards that had to be devised, the posting of links, then the task to create the project, and I needed motivated students. I had them that semester. I tried it again this session, and the outcome was different. Language proficiency was an issue this session, and that was addressed earlier. I had lower level proficiency students, and it did not go as well. And in fact, I decided to do a different project, not the newscast. And then John is going to talk about the other issues. So for the students, there was definitely more interaction. They were able to do their learning outside the classroom and in the form that they wanted, whether their mobile devices or the computer. They had autonomy. This was mentioned before. This definitely fits with 21st century expectations. Not all of them liked the online work, the homework. They had to have some access to external sources. And, of course, there are concerns that Christine mentioned earlier. So here is the list of resources for further reading. And I will check in with the monitor to see if we have time to watch that. We can watch it at the end. Yeah, of course.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to be sure I got the right city. Thank you all. We're moving on now to our fourth presenter, John Graney. John Graney is from Santa Fe College. That's not New Mexico. That's Florida.
Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm going to talk about sort of a sliver, in a sense, of flipped learning, and that is formative assessment. And I'm building on what Lane was talking about and what the two Christines were. Formative assessment, let's start with a straw man. This is the traditional classroom, which none of us have really taught, right? But in this, the teacher is in control. And the students are out there, and assessment looks something like this. You ask questions. You give quizzes. You give tests. And a lot of times the question is this. This is what happens when you move from Keynote to PowerPoint. Things get thrown off a little bit. So how many of us have ended a session with, or ended an activity with any questions? And don't get any answers, right? So, and then we do pop quizzes, among other things, for our quizzes to get formative assessment. Sometimes we use pop quizzes to say, you should have done the work. And so here's a quiz to show you that you should have done the work. But we also use quizzes to find out what they've learned, how they've done things. And we use test, which we can never get away from. Okay. Probably your program mandates you do some testing, and mine certainly does. So all of this was part of the traditional classroom. The teacher's standing up here, the students are out there. For me, when I flipped, this was the area that was frustrating, and this is where the biggest change came for me. So when I flipped, first when I flipped my classroom, and then end of flipped learning. And what I'm going to talk about really is the P in flipped learning, and that is the professional educator. And when we look at the professional educator, it says I make myself available to all students for individual, small group, and class feedback in real time as needed. In other words, we are there. This makes it a lot more dynamic because we're no longer standing up here. We're out there among the students. And P2 is I conduct ongoing formative assessments during class time through observation and by recording data to inform future instruction. And so, again, the dynamic part is there. And I was looking around because there's no real good definition for formative assessment. The definition in the P's doesn't really tell us what it is. And I found this one from Bill Youngglove, and he calls it the frequent interactive checking of student progress and understanding in order to identify learning needs and adjust teaching appropriately. And with the flipped learning, the interaction and adjusting happens right in the classroom. It's not like when I gave the quiz and I said, okay, I know I have to do something different tomorrow. This is, I know I have to do something different in 5 minutes because something's not working. Or it's working much better than I expected and I have to do something about that too. So I really like this definition because it gets to the dynamic aspect of formative assessment, and it is so crucial, I think, to making the flipped learning work. So we're basically taking everybody's temperature every minute of the classroom from the time we walk in, because when we walk in, we make a quick assessment of where the students are at today. To every time we do something, we have to check and see what's going on. So I break formative assessment into three parts. And the first part's observation. And this is the over-the-shoulder, looking at what they're doing. It's checking to see what's going on with the groups, the listening to find out how things are proceeding. And actually, I found a nice little, since this is a technology thing, I should give the technology thing, right? EduSight is a little app for the iPad which allows you to record, take notes on what they're doing, and take pictures of what they're doing. It's a very simple app, but it's a very quick way to get and take notes as you're wandering around the classroom. So, second part of formative assessment is diagnosis. And here we're talking about looking at the student, and they make a mistake or an error. And we have to decide, is it a mistake? One of those, you know, I knew that, I don't know how I made that mistake. Or is it, I don't really know what's going on here, and I need some help. And so this is what we as diagnosticians have to figure out. Okay. Then the third element is the feedback. Okay. And this is the tricky part. Because we've diagnosed it and we think, okay, that's a mistake or that's an error. But what do I do with the feedback? Well, the first thing, and the thing to keep in mind all the time, and this is the thing that I am struggling with, is to always make the feedback something that causes thinking. Okay? Because sometimes it's very easy to shut down the thinking and just give them the right answer. But really good formative feedback is something that is causing them to think, to do, to go beyond. So, and when we're doing the feedback, we have a lot of things to think about. So we have the lesson, and we have to figure out, is the student having a problem with the procedure? Did we tell them to do something and it's too complicated for this particular group or this particular student? Do I have to make an adjustment in the feedback on the procedure? Or is it knowledge? Did I push them too far, or is it too easy? You know, when the cell phones come out, we have to figure out, is it, it's not challenging, or maybe it's too hard. So again, we have to take these into consideration with our feedback. We also have to take in the student. What is their proficiency level? Because the feedback we can give to a strong student is going to be much different from the feedback we give to a weak student. And because we know our students or are getting a sense of our students, we then can tailor the feedback to that strong student or tailor the feedback to the weak student or the students that are in the middle. Okay. The other thing is what I have seen referred to as grit. And this is the learning mindset. What is the mindset of your learner? So if you tell a student who doesn't have grit, in other words, doesn't have a growth mindset, that they're wrong, they may say, I can't do this. You've just made a judgment on my intelligence saying I'm not smart enough to do this. So if you know that your student has this mindset, you make the feedback different than you do to the student who has the so-called grit mindset. The student who says, that's wrong, well, I'll figure out how to do it right this time. Even if it takes 3 or 4 attempts, they're still trying to figure out how to do it right. And so as we know our students, we know the students who, in a sense, don't have grit, and we have to tailor our feedback in a motivational way to keep them going versus the student who does have grit and can take any type of feedback as a way, well, not any type of feedback, but can take our feedback and go on. So some of the brief assessments, I'm sure you have assessments that you use that are just as effective as these. First one is obviously the over-the-shoulder where you're walking around all throughout the class figuring out what's going on with this student, what's happening here in this group. Exit ticket I have been using and find them very interesting because you say at the end of class, before you leave, you have to answer this question. And you give them a piece of paper or they tear out a piece of paper. How did the class go? Was there something you didn't understand? How much work did you do before you came to class? Or what was the really difficult part? Have them do illustrations, just a quick drawing to show what happened in a classroom. And then there's also the muddy moment, which is what didn't you understand at this in this particular lesson? Tell me so I can then make the change next. So these are some of the brief assessments, but I think the much more powerful assessment comes in the projects that we ask them to do. When we ask them to show me what you know, and we give them a real challenge, a video, make a PowerPoint, make something that shows me what you know. And we are there for the whole process as they are doing this, or for much of the process. Some of it they do at home, but for much of the process. So we're doing all of the other things in formative assessment as they are doing this. Plus we get an outcome and we can then give them additional feedback. And so that's basically what I have to say, I guess. Thank you very much. And I guess we're going to answer questions.
Thank you, John. Could the panelists come up here? And so we're very much on time. Thank you all for respecting the time thing. We've got about 15 minutes for questions. We're also going to take questions if we get any. You can let me know. So does anyone have any questions that they would like to ask? I thought maybe. I'm going to start in the back of the room. Yeah, I'm in the. That would be you. Yes, ma'am. If you need to go up more. Can you take it out there? Okay. I'll repeat it. I'll repeat the question. Yeah. I'm going to repeat your question for the people who are on the webcast.
Okay.
And I
Okay, so. So the question is, for a large classroom, what kind of challenges do you face, and how do you deal with those challenges in trying to remember assessment for all the individual students? Is that right? Okay.
Well, somebody might want to ask.
Yes, and you can moderate.
Okay.
This is okay, the app that I was talking about has, you can put their pictures, and so each time you look at a student, you click on the picture and make a note on that app. That might help with keeping the names. If you don't have the app, some way, paper where you have the pictures of the students might help you with the names.
Wait, in fact, you're quite close. If you would like to just put it here. Or
I was just going to ask, how do you handle the students who come to class unprepared? You know, they don't do it.
How do you handle the students who don't do the home part of the flipped classroom when they come to class?
Do you want to answer first? Okay.
Yeah, and believe me, that happens. Okay, it didn't happen as much that time that I did the newscast project, but it did happen this recent time. So I actually happened to do a little bit of work in the classroom, and they actually had to go outside and do something, but they had to post comments on the VoiceThread. They hadn't done their VoiceThread, so instead of having a newscast project, I changed it to a VoiceThread project. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And some of them hadn't done it, hadn't posted the link, so they had to do it in class, and trust me, that was not a fun experience, okay? The students were not motivated. They were all Chinese. And so that made for an additional difficult dynamic, you know, all the same language. But, yeah.
Okay, let me tell you what I do, because I have that problem all the time. What I do when I start class as a warm-up, I draw on what they've done. So I say to them, okay, so and I make sure I cover the key points in that little warm-up. So the ones that were lazy will realize, oh, the other ones are on top of things, I don't know the information, but they're also hearing the information. So I draw on it, and then I take off from there. That's what I do.
And I'd just like to add that we don't want to be punitive. In other words, the worst thing to do is probably make people start feeling guilty because they didn't do it. So this is something new. Whenever we try something new, there's going to be early adopters. There's going to be the ones that lag behind. So see it as change in progress. And what I saw in my class is there were people who would hold back and not do it, but the peer pressure that came through in a positive way made them realize, hey, I need to get on board. This is the way this class is running. And the other thing is I found some of them didn't understand how to interact, how to learn from what we sent home. And it's very important that you add, I don't think anyone mentioned, we have to teach them how to do this flip at home. And so the best way to start your class is to show them and model it with them. This is the kind of way you interact. Because I had some students that would just push play and stare at it and say, I watched it, and they weren't using it. They weren't processing it. So that's another thing to keep in mind. More?
Just something to share. I was doing a teacher training, a graduate student class, and my students were actual teachers. And I flipped the classroom on them with the flipped learning. So I put them as if they were their actual students in their classrooms, and they saw the hardships, and they themselves were lazy, and they didn't want to prepare. And I'm like, you know what? You guys are teachers. So you're expecting your students to do things at home, but you guys don't want to do something. So they were put into the shoes as if they were their own students. You know, so that was a very interesting result, too.
Did want to add something to that. It might seem easy, but it is a really long process to get there. And the more scaffolding you can build in, the more modeling you can do, and a lot of walking through it, showing them how to do it, that is key. And mind you, the project that I didn't get to show, which we could see if you want to, it took 4 weeks to get to, okay? So it doesn't happen overnight. And same thing with the note-taking and summarizing. That didn't happen immediately. But by the end of 4 weeks, they had it.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to get the lady. Oh, no, that's fine. Let's hear. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. So your question is, what kind of ratio would you use for out-of-class and in-class activity? Okay.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I tend to be at St. Michael's College the teacher that gives a lot of homework. Okay, so the students coming into my class, they already know that they will have some. But because it's a Tuesday-Thursday class, I give less homework and I plan it in such a way that they don't have as much from Tuesday to Thursday. But from Thursday to Tuesday, they have to do two of those news events. Okay, listen to them, take notes, summarize them, come to class with the notes prepared, and probably an additional activity. So how to balance it? Well, I kind of eyeball it and I think, okay, there's a weekend. I talk to them about it and say, okay, don't wait till Monday night to do this, okay? I did have one teacher complain about the amount of homework, and because I put everything on a wiki, I said, it's very transparent. You can see what I assign, and you can see that from Tuesday to Thursday, there isn't very much, okay? The fact that the students procrastinated is a problem that the students had, and then I talked to them, of course, but there wasn't very much, okay? So to some extent, they were exaggerating as well, okay?
Hi, we have a question for this 15 to 17.
Okay.
From Marissa of wants to know the difference between blended learning and split classes when speaking with instructors and faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Can you repeat the question?
To repeat the question, what is the difference between blended learning and flipping the classroom specifically with
when you're working with faculty and instructors?
When you're working with faculty and instructors. Okay. Yes, I think that was actually a question for this Christine because she, no, it was for me. Okay. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, blended learning is just, you know, in the definition, you've got face-to-face and you've got technology allowing you to do some work outside the classroom. So when you blend the two, it's just another way of calling it. It's basically the same thing. It used to be called blended learning. Now it's called flipped learning, but flipped learning also has additional meaning. So blended learning is just another way of talking about the environment and how technology is leveraged to accomplish that. How to do it with teachers? Well, when I do teacher training, my teacher trainees also have a lot of homework. And I actually teach online, so for example, they would be watching some of the things that I have not shown you yet on videos and then comment on them. Okay, so that would be their homework. In other words, they have to do the reading about the flipped classroom and flipped learning, and then they see some examples. I do expect them to build it into a project that they have to do. And they have to react to it. They have to comment. Okay. In the
question was also, what if other teachers? I think the question also was, what if other teachers that are also teaching what you're teaching, like sections, don't want to flip? Okay. So different methodologies taking place, but students all have to reach the same point. And I think maybe that's what she wants. Okay. So we'll take another question until she clarifies, or?
I just want to go back to the question of balancing time. With my students, I had them keep records for me. I wanted data on how much time they were spending at home, and they actually had to log it, and I had to nag them a little to do that. I want in this box this week, how much time did you spend? Because I wanted to know, and I wanted to get a sense of it. And you know what I found? It was all over the map, because some people who needed to spend more, it's differentiated instruction. Some of them would whip right through it in very short order, and others needed more time. But I think that's the beauty of flipped learning, is that when they go home with whatever you've sent them, they can spend the amount of time they need at home. So I think that's an important point to realize, that we have that opportunity. I just wanted to look to make sure that the high numbers didn't get too high. And so I did have to make some adjustments. But I think collecting data is the first step.
Did you clarify? Okay. Another question. Oh, okay.
I'm just wondering if... how flipped learning is different from telling the students, study this lesson and then we'll do exercises in class. Like, that's kind of flipping, I think, but when we talk about flipped learning here, it seems like we're talking about watching something most of the time. So what's the difference between asking the students to read a lesson that I typed up or to watch a lesson that I recorded?
Yeah, actually, my students don't watch a lesson that I recorded. I've done mostly collaborative work, and I think that's the key to your answer. Whatever they did outside the classroom, a lot of it was collaborative, so that newscast project that they had to work on, it was a collaborative thing. They had to keep analyzing, synthesizing, and creating outside the classroom. Then they also had to do some individual work, like the news logs, okay? so when I think about it, it's probably mainly the interactive collaborative piece that I would say is different from just going and do some homework, and I wouldn't have them just watch videos.
I just want to give you an example from my class. I might record a short lecture on morphology, and I would analyze some words and show them how to do a word analysis, but then they each had to pick a word of their own, come into class with their word, and make a poster and explain it to the class. So I always put in individual accountability for whatever the piece was that I was introducing to them at home. So it wasn't simply, it wasn't simply to watch or read. And a lot of them, we still had textbook readings. And some of them would say they would watch and then read, or read and then watch, or watch while they're reading. I mean, there are many different ways to do this. And I did find video was important, because I think they're getting that, they're seeing me on the webcam, and it's me, I'm their teacher, and there's that connection. And so that's the way I did it. You don't have to do it that way. Obviously, there are many ways to do it.
I think just to clarify, we're talking about different types of students here. My project was about intensive English students, okay, where I typically wouldn't do any lecturing, not in the classroom and not online, not videotaped or video recorded. But with teacher trainees, with my graduate students, yes, I would also have them watch some lessons. But I think in both, what you might want to have is your students watch something in action, so that they, graduate students can watch a video, but I think my intensive English students would not want to see me or anybody else just on a lecture. They would watch TED Talks, and those are a lot more animated, okay? They're also very short and to the point, but my point was that they had to take notes. There was another activity associated with that.
Yeah, I do believe they need to read. So they need to read and they need to see. And what I try to do is I try to use all the senses so that the encoding process of the material that they need to learn is integrating the different senses to help them take it into their long term.
I just want to mention in addressing non-video, Robin Brinks Lockwood has published a book with University of Michigan Press on flipping in ESL classrooms, and she talks a great deal about alternatives to video and other types of home assignments. She's also presenting at TESOL. She's here. And you could check out her book at University of Michigan Press.
What was the name
again? Her name? I don't know the book. It's Robin Brinks Lockwood. Lockwood as it sounds, yeah.
So thank everyone. We're out of time. So thank you for coming to the session. I hope you have a good experience in the rest of the conference. In 15 minutes, we have in here the mobile technology showcase, where there's a lot of presentation of different apps and different ways to use different apps in your classrooms. So we're going to wrap things up now. If you have questions for the panel, and I saw several people did, come up and ask them, you know, because they like interacting with everyone. Thank you very much. Thanks for being a